small tents amid the starvation that has already claimed the lives of several Palestinian children.
The situation in Gaza is very difficult. There is no food. The people are struggling to find anything to eat with flour scarce. Here in the south, they queue in long lines for food. Even those who attempt to get anything from the aid trucks are putting their lives at risk as Israeli soldiers open fire on them. I don't know what we're going to do in Ramadan.
Palestinians' catastrophe doesn't stop with the loss of their relatives. It is deepened by the full-scale destruction that has become palpable in every corner of Gaza, including mosques, which means they won't be able to say their prayers and worships as usual. Even if their mosques hadn't been destroyed, it would still be impossible for them to perform their prayers under the incessant Israeli bombardments.
The humanitarian conditions are completely disastrous. The people were displaced from several parts of Gaza, including the northern and central areas of the Strip. It is literally catastrophic. There is no source of income or food, and the people are completely relying on the small amounts of donation provided by a limited numbers of charity institutions. In addition to that, mosques have been completely destroyed by Israeli warplanes, and we will never be able to pray in them.
While some aid has been trickling into Gaza, it's minuscule compared to the needs of the Palestinians. With Ramadan arriving, more assistance cannot come soon enough for them.
As the whole Muslim nation welcomes Ramadan, Palestinians are wondering why they have been abandoned by many Muslim leaders to face the Israeli campaign of death and starvation. To Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
The Iranian National Oil and Gas Company says that this is the most strategic project in the history of Iran's oil and gas industry and its long-sought empowerment of domestic entities. Under this project, 90 trillion cubic feet of gas and 2 billion barrels of gas condensates will be available for use. Top Iranian companies, Petropars, Oil Industries Engineering and Construction, Khatam al-Anbiya Construction Headquarters, Mapna Group, and a consulting company are the contractors of the mega project.
In the subject matter of the development and increase of capacities of the gas and oil refineries, we witnessed the second phase of Abadan refinery with the capacity of 210,000 barrels, which helped the production and supply of gas in the country. In the 14th phase of the South Pars refineries, 50 million cubic feet of gas is produced per day, which again adds to the capacity of gas production in the country.
The massive project has created an opportunity to kickstart economic prosperity and employment in the face of unilateral Western sanctions. This has also allowed Iranian producers and companies to engage greatly in the economic growth and industrial development of the country and neutralize the sanctions.
Today, all Iranian people should witness the fact that the surrounding nations trust the Iranian National Oil Company and the relative competent companies and contractors and do rely on them, because they know well that the South Pass was built by Iranian companies, and the day that they thought that it was impossible to do so without the help and presence of foreigners, that exact day was the day that South Pass became what it is today.
While sanctions have forced the governing bodies to change their attitude towards domestic companies and entrust them with tasks, it should be noted that Iranian producers are not perennial supporters of sanctions. Rather, they would like to interact and acquire world-class technologies from foreign companies to empower themselves.
With contracts for developing oil and gas field signs and projects for boosting pressure in South Pars gas field being started, Iran is experiencing yet another success in the mega gas project to exploit the immense gas field. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Chants echoed through the streets of the Pakistani capital Islamabad as thousands of demonstrators gathered to condemn the United States and Israel.
Ceasefire now!
The protest, organized by Pakistan's largest religio-political party, Jamaat-e-Islami, saw passionate crowds marching through the streets, expressing solidarity with the Palestinian cause and denouncing Israel's actions, which take place with the support of the U.S.
Of course, there should be a ceasefire long ago, but even now we are pressing for it, and you have seen how irresponsible and insensitive Biden has been responding. He was just having ice cream and talking about ceasefire as if it was a very casual affair. And on the other hand, the way children are dying, women are dying from morning till night, and especially there are a lot of prisoners which are taken by Israel. And there are large number of women and children who have been taken as prisoners, and their condition is pathetic.
The acts of solidarity in Pakistan reflect widespread outrage and sympathy for the plight of the Palestinian people.
As a Pakistani citizen, I think that our government should immediately call for a ceasefire and boycott all the products that are supporting the Israeli aggression in Palestine. And I also want to say that the whole world should come out of their houses and protest, because the kids, Palestinian kids, are starving right now, and they are being starved, and they are scared, and they are homeless, and they have nothing to eat and drink, and they are dying. And how can anybody bear that?
The protesting Pakistanis called on the government to cut its ties with the U.S. over what they call the barbaric role in the killing of innocent men, women and children in Gaza.
People here in Pakistan are concerned about the ongoing atrocities committed by Israeli forces in Gaza. They are demanding that the international community enforce an immediate ceasefire by bringing the U.S. and Israel to the International Court of Justice for their war crimes in Gaza. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Syrians have long been accustomed to eagerly welcoming the holy month of Ramadan, brimming with joy and happiness. But this year has brought an unusual sense of sadness as the harsh economic conditions exacerbated by unjustified Western sanctions is casting a shadow over their celebrations. Moreover, their hearts are heavy with sorrow for their brethren in Gaza, who endure the devastating consequences of the ongoing Israeli onslaught.
We are going through a painful situation as people do not have money due to the poor economic conditions. As store owners, we are trying to consider the people's circumstances by reducing prices during Ramadan. However, basic production materials are expensive due to the importing difficulties.
Ramadan is always a special month, as it is a month of worship, patience and blessings, especially in Palestine. However, this year, it is as if Palestinians in Gaza have been fasting for more than 5 months. We pray for them and gain our determination, patience and steadfastness from them, from the brave faces of Gaza's children, the resilience of its resistance fighters, and the patience of its steadfast women.
Ramadan comes this year while the Western world, which claims freedom and humanity, practices double standards with the people of Gaza, who are suffering from hunger, blockade, and Israeli crimes. Palestinians are paying the price for demanding their freedom and legitimate rights. Syrians will always stand with them until the final victory over the Zionist regime and the liberation of the occupied lands.
The month of Ramadan comes this year amid the continued unjust Western economic blockade on Syria. We see our people in Gaza suffering from blockade, hunger, killing, destruction, and continuous Zionist aggression without deterrent.
Syrians are a living nation because they have defended resistance, and the Palestinian people are the soul of resistance. We say to the West, you will lose, and the access of resistance from Iran to Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Yemen will prevail. We will break the Caesar Act and all your blockades on Syria and Gaza, and we will all pray in Al-Quds.
Syrian message to their brothers and sisters in Gaza is that no matter how difficult our circumstances may be, your tragedy in Gaza remains even more challenging, and your resilience is an inspiration not only for us, but for all free people around the world.
Syrians welcome Ramadan this year amid hard economic conditions due to unjust Western sanctions and with heavy hearts for their besieged brothers and sisters in Gaza. Yet their commitment to the resistance fuels their faith in eventual victory. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Yemenis is from all walks of life gathered in the capital Sana'a and other major cities and chanted slogans in praise of the Yemeni army's naval operations. They also reaffirmed their full support for the Palestinian people and pledged to continue the protests until the Israeli genocide ceases.
The Yemeni government, all its members, its president and the people have one position, which is to support the Palestinian cause. We must thwart the American, Israeli and British project and stop starvation in Palestine. Our position is an honorable position and our broad movement indicates that the Yemenis have great awareness and, God willing, victories for the nation will be at hand.
Protesters expressed support for the Yemeni army's naval operations against Western vessels, stating that the Palestinian cause helped the Yemeni people overcome the problems created by the Western powers in the country. They believe the conspiracy targets the whole region, not just Palestine or Yemen, and call on all Muslims to unite to thwart Western projects.
We went out today in Sana'a, as you can see, and in the rest of the governorates to announce to the world that our demonstrations and our position is a religious position that will not change with regimes or rulers. We will continue to insist on our position until our brothers in Gaza are victorious, receive food and medicine, and the U.S.-Israeli genocide against them stops. Our army will also continue its operations until the aggression against our country stops. Our operations are escalating, and upcoming strikes will stun both friends and enemies.
Our demonstration here in Sana'a and other governorates is to send a message that we as Yemenis have been able to overcome all the differences and problems that the enemies sought to create inside Yemen. The other message is that we continue to support the Palestinian cause, and what is happening in Gaza is shameful for all Arabs and Muslims. The operations of our army in the Red Sea and Bab al-Mandab are completely linked to what is happening to the people of Gaza, and the escalation of naval military operations is a legitimate move to support the Palestinian cause.
Recently, the Yemeni army intensified its naval attacks against American, British and Israeli-linked vessels and regional waterways, resulting in the sinking of a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. It also attacked an American vessel, which the U.S. claimed led to loss of lives among the ship's crew members.
Yemenis assert that the success of Yemeni naval attacks, despite the presence of Western warships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, demonstrates the capability and the high-tech weaponry possessed by the Yemeni army. They believe this achievement should inspire other regional forces to join the fight and support the Palestinians in face of the common enemies. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
In recent years, Iran and Russia have significantly enhanced their cooperation in a wide range of fields. A key driving force behind the growth of bilateral relations between the two countries is forging a new geoeconomic reality in one of the world's most strategic regions. Both nations have been pursuing several objectives in this regard. They have been after establishing an independent monetary system, energy market, and parallel supply chains outside the control of Western regulatory frameworks to circumvent sanctions imposed in an attempt to isolate them. And their efforts have yielded significant success. In the field of trade, despite facing severe sanctions, Iran has managed to surpass the $2 billion threshold in exports to Russia. Iran's exports to Russia predominantly consist of fruits, polymer products, vehicles, non-metal minerals, and chemical products. Similarly, Russian exports to Iran, valued at the same amount, mainly comprise agricultural products. Iranian officials have hailed the economic cooperation between the two nations as closer than ever.
Analyzing the export trend, we see an acceptable growth in all sectors, with Iran's exports to Russia witnessing a notable increase in both volume and value. This progress not only contributes to the advancement of the two nations, but also lays the foundation for the development of other regional countries.
The total value of annual bilateral trade between the two countries reached $4.9 billion in 2023, according to Iran's official statistics. A Russian economic delegation was in Tehran in late February for the 17th round of their Joint Economic Commission. Both sides then pledged to boost trade tenfold over the coming years. Mahdi Abusyan, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In the 2024 annual threat assessment report issued on Monday, United States intelligence agencies point at the risk of broader conflict related to the Israeli war against Gaza. The report also notes that Netanyahu's viability as a leader, as well as his governing coalition of far-right parties, may be in jeopardy. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Stay with us and we'll review and discuss different aspects of the Israeli failures in the deadly onslaught against Gaza in the eyes of U.S. intelligence apparatus. Now let me introduce our guests. Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, is joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Also with us is George Samueli, senior research fellow with Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University, out of Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's begin with Ray. According to this U.S. intelligence report, Tel Aviv seems adamant to want to destroy Hamas, that, of course, enjoys great public support in Gaza. It predicts that the Israeli regime could face a lingering armed resistance from Hamas for years. I'm quoting it directly. So, and as you see, they're already running short of their soldiers. They have to pass this legislation the other day to recruit ultra-Orthodox Jews who've always enjoyed exemptions from, you know, doing military service. Let's have your take on that.
You said Tel Aviv, in speaking of the Israeli government, this assessment, unfortunately, says Jerusalem. Things have changed. The CIA used to be a lot more objective. Let me start with the good news. The good news is that there was no Middle East section to the annual threat assessment last year. Jacob Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, who pretty much is a very smart guy, knew what was going to happen, and so he had a 7,000-word essay in Foreign Affairs, and it concluded 5 days before the October 7th attacks. Mm-hmm. The Middle East, I quote, "The Middle East is quieter than it has been in decades." Mm-hmm. "Serious frictions have decreased, and we have," quote, "de-escalated crises in Gaza," end quote. So this is small praise, but at least they have a section on Gaza, and atypically, they have a section on Israel. Now, what does that section amount to? Not much at all. We have a fifth-grade son who is exposed to 10 minutes of CNN every morning at elementary school. CNN, 10 minutes for grade schoolers, I could have written, and it sounds very much like what was written here. The main issues are not addressed, and when they are mentioned, the fact that Netanyahu may be in trouble and that a more moderate government might come in, well, that's not very helpful. You can glean that from any newspaper. So, again, I'm not surprised, but I am disappointed, except for a couple of things which are more positive, and I can mention those later.
Okay. Now, George, this report, what's interesting is that they're kind of actually alluding to the military and combat readiness of the Hamas movement, and that this will going to take a long time for Israel. And also some other aspects, which we'll also discuss at a later time. Let's have your perspective of this.
Well, I agree with Ray that there's really very little that's new here, or very little that's surprising. The one thing that I found, maybe surprising isn't quite the word, but that the CIA evidently doesn't believe that there's much likelihood of a war between Israel and Iran. You would have thought that they want to maybe hype up the possibility of a confrontation. They're always warning about the dire threat posed by Iran. But here they kind of minimize this. They say that no, Israel and Iran are unlikely to reach a military confrontation. And indeed, the report then also says it's unlikely that Israel and Hezbollah will lead to a greater confrontation than just simply skirmishes across the border. So I thought that was quite surprising that you would say that's a reasonably optimistic assessment. However, overall, one can say that this war is likely to go on for quite some time, and I think the threat assessment does confirm that there is not likely to be any resolution or any prospect of something a workable framework developing anytime soon.
Okay. Now, Ray, another aspect, the media coverage of the destruction and loss of life that's the reports is being amplified by social media is roiling public reactions by both neighboring countries and other countries elsewhere in the world. An instance is just we had Netherlands the other day, Vienna rally, for instance, and many other places, even inside the United States. Now, do you agree that Israel has gained hatred and indignation of the people of many countries by what it's doing in Gaza?
Well, it has, of course. And this is, again, a symptom of playing down controversial issues. It's not very revealing that social media are playing a major role in this conflict. I would add one thing that George and I have not yet mentioned. There are two rather positive things here. One is the reiteration that Iran had nothing to do with the October 7 attacks. As a matter of fact, it goes further and it says Iran didn't know
had no knowledge,
the October 7 attacks. So that was big. The other thing, and this is not negligible when you're talking about Iran, Israel. Israel, of course, always says that Iran is working on a nuclear weapon. The U.S. intelligence community, to its credit, for the 17th straight year, says, let me read this so I don't paraphrase it, quote, Iran is not currently undertaking the key nuclear weapons development activities necessary to produce a testable nuclear device. That's big. The U.S. intelligence community has resisted all kinds of pressure, not only from the likes of Netanyahu, but from the likes of the neoconservatives in the United States, to change that reading. It was in 2007 that an honest estimate was done on that. The fact that it's reiterated here is more than just looking for something favorable. This is significant, and the fact that the rest of it is pretty much pedestrian, well, this included is a positive sign.
All right, George, the report also warns that the conflict in Gaza highlights the potential for a spillover into a larger and more dangerous conflict. This is what Tehran has warned on multiple occasions. What's your assessment?
Well, it does say that, but as I said, it draws a line on the possibility, which is clearly the one that everyone's sort of afraid of, which is that there could be a war between Israel and Iran, which would, of course, drag the United States into it. But the report rather minimizes that. It really doesn't think that either Israel or Iran wants to get into a military confrontation. It does talk about Iran's proxies and possibility of increased skirmishes between Israel and these proxies, but it doesn't really go where you would expect a threat assessment to go, which is that, well, there could be a massive war in the Middle East. It doesn't seem to say that. And above all, where you might have been thinking, well, what about Hezbollah? Because that's obviously the big enchilada. There, somehow, again, they say, well, you know, Hezbollah is very wary of Israel, knows that it'll lead to the destruction of Lebanon. Hezbollah is unlikely to want a major confrontation with Israel. So it's not that pessimistic as far as the wider war goes. It's quite pessimistic about Gaza, however.
Now, Ray, what's your opinion about the spillover? How likely is that, and what could the repercussions be in that case?
Well, the likelihood of spillover is very, very great. The fact that it's sort of dusted off just testifies to the prosaic aspect of this briefing. That is the big question. Whether Israel will attack Lebanon as it said it would? What's missing here, in a word, is any realistic appraisal of the situation, because the United States of America is a key player here.
Right.
And what you get here is not the question that is really to be posed, and that is, what would it take Netanyahu to stop the genocide? How much U.S. pressure would that take? Would it take just a telephone call? My view is yes, that's all it would take. And that would end all this business about Hezbollah coming in. So you have, instead of this addressing the key question, you have things pitched at the, as I said before, the fifth grade elementary school level, which I suppose is appropriate for most congresspeople, I regret to say. But it's a kind of a briefing for them. You know, this is the state of the world, and this is where it looks. It doesn't really help the president or the Congress to say, well, how do we stop this thing before it evolves out of control? Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran are trying to control it. It's Israel that's the main problem, and we have a hold over Israel because we are enabling the genocide with our weapons and with our political support, our vetoes at the Security Council, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. All we have to do is change our policy. And of course, intelligence people have to pretty much shy away from that, because to be too blunt on that is to expose yourself to charges of politicization and worse.
Okay. Now, George, let's now turn to a number of Arab states in the midst of this. And this Gaza war is said to be posing a challenge to many of them. You know, on the streets, people are expressing their views. They are standing by Palestinians. They condemn Israeli crimes. But to Arab states, the authorities do not necessarily share the same views. And some of them, they already signed the so-called deal of the century to normalize relations. And some of them, of course, regret it at this point. But you see that a number of them are just sitting there doing nothing, or maximum what they're doing is simply giving lip service and condemning every now and then.
Well, that's right. It's very unfortunate that a number of the Arab states are mostly concerned with how can they make more money. And they're thinking of those, well, we can make deals involving Israel. So we have the plan that the United States has signed on to as a kind of alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative, which will involve a kind of a big infrastructure project, you know, going from India and then through the Gulf States and into Israel and then on to, into the Mediterranean and then onto Greece. This is the way they're thinking. They think, well, hey, this is fantastic. You know, we can make a lot of money. And this is obviously also the way Netanyahu is thinking. If we recall, when Netanyahu was stood before the UN General Assembly last September, basically just a few days before the 7th of October, and he pointed to a map of the new Middle East in which there was no room for Palestine, that's what he was thinking about. He was thinking about, hey, this is fantastic. We're going to have this great infrastructure project, you know, linking Israel to these wealthy Gulf states and into the Mediterranean. No room there for Palestinians. But unfortunately, and this is why Netanyahu thought, hey, I don't have to worry about the Palestinians. He has the support of these Arab states who are all looking to make some money out of all of this.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ray, another aspect mentioned in this report is has to do with the resistance front, with Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iraqi resistance, and also the Yemenis that are operating in the Red Sea and Arabian Sea, targeting Israel-linked ships, and recently U.S. and U.K. Ships. And this report foresees that those operations by these three fronts will be going on. So right. Do you also agree with the same prediction?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, it's interesting that they always use the term resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, resistance to what? Like maybe genocide? Like maybe oppression for 70 years? So that's the resistance. And unless the causes of the resistance are addressed, there will be resistance forever. One puzzling part of this thing, or one complicating part, is that the head of the CIA is a member of the cabinet making decisions and also trying to negotiate the exchange of hostages and so forth. That is really, really noxious because nobody can take seriously an intelligence officer who is also implementing and forming policy. So this kind of document under the hand of William Burns and his nominal supervisor, April Haynes, really is hostage to what the director of the CIA is actually doing operationally as well, and ipso facto cannot be viewed as a totally objective briefing from intelligence.
Okay. Now, George, this U.S. intelligence report also argues that the distrust of Netanyahu's ability, I'm quoting, distrust of Netanyahu's ability to rule has deepened and broadened across the public from its already high levels before the war, and that they expect large protests demanding his resignation and new elections. A different, more moderate government is a possibility. Well, this is the U.S. intelligence assessment. What's yours?
Well, it's very interesting because, of course, that is the view of the U.S. government, which has always found Netanyahu a little bit of an embarrassment, just as it has always found Likud a bit of an embarrassment, even going back to the days of Menachem Begin. One shouldn't take any of that too seriously. The United States is obviously more comfortable with the so-called liberals of Israel, who really don't disagree with Netanyahu very much on the issue of Palestine. They don't disagree with his policies in West Bank or in Gaza. They do disagree on other issues, which are basically about internal Israeli politics. It's not really important. But somehow, American liberals feel more comfortable embracing people they deem to be Israeli liberals, even though these Israeli liberals actually, like, you know, Gantz, who's a member of Netanyahu's government, even though they pursue exactly the same policies. So, but they think, okay, well, at least those policies will have the same policies, but we'll have nicer people running it. So I don't take that terribly seriously.
Right. Yeah, Ray, how do you look at it? Does the U.S. really want what they call more moderate government?
The U.S. is fixated on the United States presidential election right now. Biden and his rival need money. The Israel lobby has the money. That's what they're fixated on now. Mm-hmm. As for the Israelis, You know, in 2001, when Netanyahu thought he was off the microphone, he said, and I quote, "I know the Americans, they're easily moved in the right direction." Would you believe it? 80% of the Americans support us no matter what we do. That's absurd. End quote. Now, It's no longer 80%, maybe 50%. But it's still an appreciable majority because of our press and because of the Congress people who need the money, of which George spoke before. So that's what the U.S. faces in terms of its political structure. Netanyahu is riding high. He's very vulnerable. But until the war ends, he's the guy you have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. George, if the U.S. really doesn't want somebody like Netanyahu, why does it keep supporting his regime, you know, saying stop the killing, protect civilians and all that jazz? But on the ground, you see it's U.S.-made weapons taking the lives of civilians.
Of course it is. That's why all this talk about how they don't like Netanyahu, that Biden's patience is running thin, that they're supposedly putting pressure on Netanyahu behind the scenes, all of that is just a lot of nonsense. The Biden administration has a problem, as they alluded to by Ray. There's an election coming up. He saw what happened in Michigan, and he's clearly very worried that many people, particularly Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, are not going to vote for him. And so he has to put on this this front that somehow he's terribly, terribly unhappy with what Israel is doing, when if it was true that he was unhappy with what Israel was doing, he could bring it to an end. I mean, you know, it wouldn't be hard. I mean, you know, it really would take a phone call to say, that's it, we're cutting you off, you're not getting another penny from us. He's not going to do it. So therefore, his only resort is to leak things to the New York Times or the Washington Post to tell them how very unhappy he is, and he's really getting very tired of Netanyahu. And Netanyahu contemptuously said the other day, apropos of Biden's red line about going into Rafah, and he said, hey, you know what my red line is? No more October the 7th attacks. So, you know, Netanyahu rightly treats the U.S. administrations with disdain.
Right. Now, Ray, what do you see on the horizon? Where will all of this end up in?
Well, let me try to put some threads together here.
Sure.
We have the Palestinian people, huge populations in Jordan, in Lebanon, even in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt. When will the rulers of those countries give appropriate heed to their wishes? Well, they aren't doing it yet. But let's say Biden's non-existent red line, which he said to MSNBC, they asked him, red line? Well, yeah, it's a red line, but not a red line. And, you know, if 30,000 more Palestinians are killed, my God, that's no red line. So is there no limit to the patience of these cowardly Arab countries and Turkey that talk a big game but don't do anything? Mm-hmm. I don't know. But Hezbollah is not going to wait forever. And if the Israelis hit Hezbollah, there will be a war on the northern front as well. Israel will not be able to continue at its genocide in Gaza much longer, in my view.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this show. Thank you, my guests, Ray McGovern in Raleigh, North Carolina, George Zamorli in Budapest. And thank you for watching this edition of The Spotlight.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
In Britain, Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt has made no mention of the fact that the government's flagship plan to send refugees to Rwanda will cost the British taxpayer overall more than £500 million. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has suffered his heaviest defeat in the House of Lords after the Archbishop of Canterbury and former Conservative ministers joined forces with the opposition to force through 5 amendments to the Rwanda deportation bill. The string of government setbacks, most passed by unusually large margins of about 100 votes, means the legislation which aims to clear the way to send asylum seekers on a one-way flight to Kigali in Rwanda will have to go back to the House of Commons. The Prime Minister has previously warned the unelected chamber against frustrating the will of the people by hampering the passage of his Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill, which has been approved by MPs. Rishi Sunak has made stopping the boats a key pledge of his leadership. However, he has been hit by several setbacks, including the bill being challenged in the courts of law. Recently, official auditors said it will cost £1.8 million to send each of 300 migrants to Rwanda. The draft legislation and a treaty with Rwanda are intended to prevent further legal challenges to the stalled deportation scheme after the Supreme Court ruled the plan was unlawful. As well as compelling judges to regard the East African country as safe, it would give ministers the power to ignore emergency injunctions. It has been warned that the legislation is fundamentally incompatible with Britain's human rights obligations and would flout international law. But No. 10 Downing Street has said the government remains committed to sending flights to Rwanda in the spring. In all, peers backed 5 changes to the bill recently, including ensuring it complied with the rule of law and that Parliament cannot declare Rwanda to be safe until the treaty with its promised safeguards is fully implemented. The Lords also supported a move that would allow the presumption the country is a secure haven to be challenged in the courts of law. Among those to vote against the government were the Archbishop of Canterbury, Reverend Justin Welby, and Conservative grandees Kenneth Clark, Lord Devon, and Viscount Hailsham, who have all previously held cabinet positions. The size of the defeats raised the prospect of an extended tussle between the House of Commons and the House of Lords during ping-pong, in which legislation is battled between the two houses until agreement is reached. The barrister and independent crossbencher David Anderson said the provision in the bill requiring Rwanda to be treated as safe takes us for fools. Proposing an amendment that would allow the presumption to be challenged in the courts of law, Lord Anderson added, "If Rwanda is safe as the government would have us declare, it has nothing to fear from such scrutiny." The Archbishop of Canterbury, Reverend Justin Welby, said international human rights law had developed following the horrors committed by Nazi Germany to act as a fallback and stop on governments. The Archbishop said, "We are not in any situation remotely like that, let's be clear," adding, "The government is not doing something on the scale of what we saw at that stage, but the government is challenging the right of international law to constrain our actions." Lord Kenneth Clark, the former Chancellor, said he hoped there would be a legal challenge to the bill if it was passed. He said, "I cannot recall a precedent in my time where a government of any complexion have produced a bill which asserts, a matter of fact, facts to be fact. Later, responding to concerns about the mental health support asylum seekers would receive in Rwanda, the Home Office Minister, Andrew Sharp, said, "It would be far in the best interest, mental health interest of those seeking asylum and who are victims to seek asylum in the first safe country they come to." The government recently faces the threat of further defeats when the bill is again before the House of Lords. Britain and France are planning to establish a new customs partnership designed to disrupt the supply chain of small boats in the Channel. Recently, James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, hosted a meeting in Brussels, Belgium, of the Calais Group of Northern European countries. They plan to disrupt the supply chain of boats, parts, including engines and building materials. Website Reddit has also covered the same story. Not surprisingly, in its budget, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, made no mention of the fact that the government's flagship plan to send refugees to Rwanda will cost British taxpayers overall more than £500 million. As the National Audit Office has revealed, for each of the first 300 people that will be flown to Kigali, Rwanda, it will cost a staggering £1.8 million. It is hard to believe that it was almost 2 years ago, in a speech in the Rwandan capital, that Priti Patel, the then Home Secretary, presented the UK-Rwanda deal to the world as a so-called groundbreaking agreement. Yet the government is still trying to get more laws through Parliament to make it happen. Having already passed the Illegal Migration Act, which, as was made clear by the UNHCR, amounts to an asylum ban, the Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill is now reaching its final stages, with the House of Lords voting to radically amend it recently. Prominent peers, including those on the government benches, expressed deep dismay that the bill rides roughshod over the rule of law by overturning the Supreme Court judgment that Rwanda is not a safe country to which to send people seeking asylum. Lord Tugendhat, the Conservative peer, whose nephew, Tom Tugendhat, is a Home Office minister, lambasted the government for behaving like the ruling party in George Orwell's 1984. The barrister and independent crossbencher, Lord Anderson, pointedly said that the legislation takes us for fools. In all, peers have made 10 changes to the bill, including ensuring it complies with the rule of law and that Parliament cannot declare Rwanda to be safe until the treaty that governs removals to the East African country, which includes safeguards, is fully implemented. The laws also made important amendments to ensure far greater protections for victims of modern slavery and human trafficking, and for children whose age is disputed. The bill will return to the House of Commons in less than 2 weeks, and the government will certainly reject all the law's amendments. The word in Westminster is that the only very modest concession No. 10 Downing Street is prepared to offer is to put in place an independent monitoring mechanism. This would replace the current arrangements for a monitoring committee that has already been appointed by the UK and Rwandan governments and includes those supportive of the policy, such as Alexander Downer, a former Australian politician who has been a vocal advocate for the new legislation.
Thank you.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.